Hello and welcome to 10 by 9, where 9 people have up to 10 minutes each to tell a true story from their own life. I'm Paul Dorn, and this is the 10 by 9 podcast. I was out on the road again recently with a trip to the wonderful Rove Valley Arts Centre in Limavady. That's a town about 60 miles from Belfast. There's always a full house and a warm welcome when we're there, but as it was Halloween, there was an extra buzz. It was Wednesday, October the 30th, and the theme was, appropriately, Halloween. But as always, the stories didn't go where you might have expected.
I lost it with her and pointed out that I had in fact achieved higher grades than she ever did, and without putting in the required work. This went down poorly.
And I felt a wet deluge streaming down my back, right through to my freshly washed and dried only pair of underwear.
And yet, in the days and years that followed, I wanted so much to be haunted. I yearned for Jen's ghost to come visit me.
So get ready for instructions for dying, a nightmare shortage of underwear, and a wish for a haunting. Okay, let's get started. And it was just his second time joining us at the 10x9 mic. Here's, appropriately, Mike Carlisle.
Halloween 1951 was an important day in our family. It was the day my mum was born. Growing up, we loved Halloween, which is a strange thing for the son of a Presbyterian minister in Northern Ireland to say. When I was a kid, we would duck for apples, eat apple pies with a coin covered in foil buried deep within them, but it was all about mum. Like so many, my relationship with my mum was complicated. I loved her, but I also resented her. No big reason, just a million little ones. When my generation misbehaved, our parents didn't march up to the principal's office in our defense. We received a scalp. This consisted of a hand set to 45 degrees aimed across the back of your head. It wasn't a punch, there was no closed fist, it wasn't a slap, there was no follow-through, it was a scalp. The hand would bounce off your head, causing you to bounce up in the air. It stung. Depending on how heinous your crime was, you may have received a second scalp. There were rumors of some boys in my class even receiving a third, but my family were restrained. Two was the maximum. Dad never dished out the punishment. He was, and still is, too soft. Mum was the executioner in our house. I received many a scalp over the first 12 years in my life. In one Halloween, it all changed. I had misbehaved again. Mum brought me into the dining room. Yes, we are middle class. Mum raised her hand for the usual scalp. She brought her hand down towards the side of my head. My instincts kicked in. I had been attending jiu-jitsu training, and I blocked the scalp. No one I knew had ever blocked the scalp before. I did not know what to do. Mum did not know what to do. We looked each other in the eye for what seemed an eternity, and then she walked out. In January 2013, my mum stopped talking mid-sentence. She didn't pause and continue, she stopped. She didn't forget what she was saying, she forgot that she was talking at all. A doctor suggested we get a CT scan. This led to a neurologist, a biopsy, an MRI. Mum was given medication that I cannot pronounce and told that she had a brain tumor. Halloween 1987. I attended a Halloween disco at my school. The best costume won a prize. Back when the prize was normally a Mars bar, this year was different because the prize was a £5 token for Stuart Miller. For that kind of moolah, I could get two He-Man figures. One problem, our family had a dearth of costumes. We had an old pirate hat and an eye patch that no longer fitted, and a plastic sword and shield that my dad told me were definitely authentic Roman centurion. Also, at this point, we had no money. We were not yet middle class. But I really wanted that £5 book token. So Mum made me a costume. She made, out of blue card and tissue, a hat with a rim 2.5 feet in diameter, and dangled long strips of ripped up tissue from the edge. I was a jellyfish. This was made evident to the other revelers at the Halloween disco by the piece of paper I had pinned to my blue t-shirt that read, "Jellyfish." I won. Thanks, Mum. Later in 2013, Mum was told she had an inoperable anaplastic cytoma. She needed radiotherapy. She was given 2 to 3 years to live. She lasted a further 11. Instructions for dying. Number one, do it quickly. 3 years later, my parents moved house. The social worker advised them that at their age, they should sleep in a downstairs bedroom. They did not follow this advice. Later, Mum underwent chemotherapy. Mum had 4 sessions of chemo before one night leaving her bed to go to the toilet. My dad was woken by a strange moaning he couldn't identify. He rose to investigate and found Mum in a crumpled heap at the bottom of the stairs. The chemo and the new home layout had confused her. She had fallen all the way down every step. One evening, a little later, Dad was out. While he was away, Mum had knelt down to blow out a candle that was on the hearth. When Dad arrived back home, he found Mum lying on the ground. She had been unable to get up, so she lay on the floor waiting for him for 2 hours. She never walked more than a few hundred yards again. Instructions for dying. Number one, do it quickly. Number two, don't lose mobility. In the summer of 1995, we moved from Bangor to Newry. Our middle classness well established at this point. We got in professional movers. During the move, I discovered that my mum had a guitar. We arrived in Newry 3 weeks before school started. There was nothing else for it but to teach myself to play guitar. I grabbed a book and started to learn, of course, The House of the Rising Sun. Before long, I was playing Nirvana and Therapy on this old classical guitar, and inevitably, a string broke. My mum's response to this was, "You're playing that too hard. Those strings have been on that guitar since 1976. By mum's reckoning, guitar strings that don't last a full 2 decades are not worth the 5 pence they charged her in the mid-70s. Decades later, mum got herself a beautiful Taylor guitar. None of us knew why. She was terrible and rarely played. But by that stage, our middle classness had come with the perk that we all pursue, surplus income. By 2019, it was clear that she was not going to be able to play the guitar ever again. A significant moment for the guitar-playing members of my family, so my brother claimed it before I could. Instructions for dying. Number one, do it quickly. Number two, don't lose mobility. Getting my A-level results in 1999 was not fun. I attended a school in Banbridge, but when the results came out, we were holidaying in Portrush. Our middle classness taking a hit, so we couldn't go to Mallorca that year. My mum and I drove to Banbridge in the rain. It was a tense car journey. I knew that I had not done enough work to do well in the exams. She was irritated. I did not know why. I did okay. I didn't get the results I needed to get into the course I wanted to do. My mum was very angry at my lack of work. I lost it with her and pointed out that I had in fact achieved higher grades than she ever did, and without putting in the required work. This went down poorly. If the journey down was tense, I cannot think of a word to describe the what felt like 15-month journey back up to Portrush. Years later, I found out that around that time, Mum had told my dad that if we were not leaving Newry as a family, she would be leaving alone as a divorcee. Maybe it's not that our relationship was complicated, but that Mum, being a human being, was in fact complicated. Mum was always in charge of the finances, insurances, mortgage. She always had more of a head of numbers than Dad. She organized holidays, appliance purchases, school uniforms. She always had a better head for organization than Dad, until one day she didn't. She started asking about her parents' health. They had died 30 years earlier. She asked if my sister Claire had got back from Jane's house yet. Claire hadn't been in Jane's house for at least 2 decades. Every time I came to visit, she would ask if the turkey had been put on yet. We learned there was no point in explaining to her that it was in fact April, And then if we put the turkey on now, that it would be drier than Richard Iowati by Christmas. I often responded to this request by going off to check on the turkey, crying in the kitchen alone, and then walking back, by which time she'd forgotten she even asked the question. Instructions for dying. Number one, do it quickly. Number two, don't lose mobility. Number three, don't lose your mind. During the 11-year death sentence, Mum had multiple hospital admissions for shingles, pneumonia, infections, respiratory problems. There isn't a care facility in North Down that she didn't visit. Each time I got the call telling me she was in hospital, I assumed this was it. It never was. Dad and I talk every Sunday afternoon. Any other day that I would see his name appear on my phone, I would assume this is it. But it never was. Until 10 weeks ago today, I received a call in my kitchen from my dad saying, she has gone. Instructions for dying. Number one, do it quickly. I'm glad you ignored rule number one. If you hadn't, you never would have met your final grandchild, my son Ezra. He still shouts nanny when we arrive at Dad's house. I hope he always does.
Mike, thank you so much. What a wonderful story and what a wonderfully complex woman your mum was. I hope we'll be back with more stories soon. And as I remind you on every podcast, 10 by 9 is always on the lookout for storytellers, whether new or returning. So get in touch at 10by9.com, whether it's just a vague idea or a fully fledged saga. Okay, on to our next story. And she's a regular when we go to the Northwest, as well as often making the trip to the Black Box these days. Here's Gloria O'Connor. A little bit of context. Derry goes wild at Halloween every year. And it's amazing. For most people.
I think my husband and I must be about the only two people in Derry who aren't into Halloween. So with that in mind, we try every year to get away somewhere. A couple of years ago, we planned a trip to Lisbon and Portugal to escape all the madness. With great anticipation, we headed off to Belfast International Airport for our flight, only to discover when we got there that there was a 2-hour delay. It's always a bit of a heart sink, isn't it, when that happens? But then the 2 hours turned into three. And my first thought was that there was a chance that we might be too late to get a drink when we arrived. So off I went to the duty-free and happily bought 2 bottles of wine at a somewhat inflated price. I returned to where my husband was sitting, only to discover the latest flight update that said our flight was now going to be leaving out of Dublin because of adverse weather conditions and that they would bus us all down there. This was not good news for me, as I am a terrible traveller, especially on buses. I checked to see if I had a plastic bag just in case and prepared for the worst. As we all made our way to the assembly point, I really felt sorry for a group of teachers who were trying to keep a large group of 12 to 13-year-olds under control. Then I had a sudden realization, confirmed by the security staff, that we would have to go through security again in Dublin and my 2 bottles of wine might be confiscated. I rushed back to duty free to the very pleasant lady who had sold me the wine and asked for my money back. Not without a receipt, she informed me sweetly, but with unshakable determination. I couldn't find it. I was getting a little stressed and flustered at this stage, and I maybe wasn't quite as polite as I could have been. And after all, I just bought them from her less than half an hour ago. After a bit more searching and muttering under my breath, I found the receipt and triumphantly slapped it on the counter. Back at the assembly point in the pouring rain, we were then informed that there were no buses available, and we would be taken to Dublin by taxis. Well, Ryanair hadn't banked on a group of very fraught and angry teachers from Lurgan. There is no way, they declared, that we are sending these kids in separate taxis. We don't have enough teachers to accompany them all, and it would be breaking the safeguarding rules. There really was no arguing with this logic. And the next announcement said that they would fly a plane up from Dublin, and we would fly out of Belfast after all. Why didn't they say that in the first place? I desperately wanted to go back and buy my 2 bottles of wine again. but I remembered the saleswoman's unimpressed face and decided against it. At this stage, I remember messaging my grown-up kids and saying that this is getting so ridiculous that I can feel a 10 by 9 story coming on. That's what happens when you do too many of these events. My son-in-law replied, at least you'll be able to claim compensation for the delay. I checked the policy, and it turns out that Ryanair pay compensation after 5 hours of delay. They had us taken off 4 hours and 52 minutes late. Good old Ryanair. The disruption to our plans didn't end there, however. When we arrived at our apartments in Lisbon, right, in pouring rain, we were informed that due to an error in booking, our apartment was not available, and we would be put up in the 5-star hotel next door with complimentary breakfast to make up for their mistake. Not bad, you might think. But I was mentally going through the contents of my luggage to see if it was up to a 5-star hotel. I was very much afraid that I'd be found lacking. It was getting late now, but fortunately the rooftop restaurant was still open, so off we went after a very speedy change of clothes. The food was exquisite, even if the bill made our eyes water a little. But never mind, as my old auntie would have said, sure, you're on your holidays. The major drawback for me with this beautiful hotel was that our room was on the 11th floor. Now, I don't like buses, but I also don't like lifts, and the stairs were for staff use only. It turned out that the lift for a 5-star hotel was surprisingly slow and noisy, so it was a bit of a white-knuckle ride for me, which I was only prepared to do once or twice a day at most. I have always considered myself to be a very organized person when it comes to packing for holidays. So I was very disappointed the following morning to discover that I had forgotten to pack a very essential part of my wardrobe. Clean underwear. So going commando, and with my only pair of undergarments washed and drying over the bathroom rail, we rode the elevator of death down to the ground floor and enjoyed a fabulous complimentary breakfast, mimosas and all. Although it was still raining heavily, we set out to get me some new underwear. That shouldn't be difficult, you'd think, as we were right in the middle of a famous shopping area. Famous indeed. There was Gucci, Chanel, Prada, Guess, Louis Vuitton, and any other exclusive brand that you can name. As it turned out, only a few of these actually sold underwear. And of the ones that did, the cheapest was nearly 50 euro a pair. Well, I definitely wasn't going to pay that. Although I did splash out on a rather expensive new leather jacket that I convinced my husband to go halves with me for an early Christmas present. That's how expensive it was. We had to go halves. Getting tired and hungry again now, we trudged wearily back to the hotel to get dressed for dinner. Never mind, I thought. Tomorrow I'll go looking for a Primark or something similar. The rain was pretty much non-stop since we arrived, but we bought umbrellas and got ourselves ready for dinner that evening. We had a delightful meal sitting under an awning outside the restaurant while we watched the never-ending rain beating down on the cobbled streets. Every so often, the waiter would lift the awning with a broom handle to drain off the rain that had collected. Feeling mellow now, after a couple of glasses of wine, I watched him with interest as I leaned back in my chair. Too far back, as it turned out. And I felt a wet deluge streaming down my back, right through to my freshly washed and dried only pair of underwear. The next day was Sunday, but I was determined to find a store that sold affordable undergarments, so off we went with Google Maps to guide us. Shopping centres near me, I asked of Google Maps. And it took us to some very strange places, including art galleries and pet shops, but still no underwear. And every time it was 1.6 or 1.7 kilometres from the previous disappointment. Right, Primark near me, I asked next. And sure enough, it told me there was 1-2 kilometres away. Off we trudged again and rounded the last corner to find that it was closed. Google Maps hadn't informed us of that piece of important information. In the end, we were only staying for a few nights, so I gave up the hunt for underwear and made do with washing and drying my only pair a few more times. On our last night going out to dinner, dressed in my expensive new leather jacket and going commando again out of necessity, my husband laughed and said, "You know, you really are all fur coat and no niggers."
Ah, Gloria, you are brilliant. Thanks so much. I'll try not to think about you going commando next time you come to 10x9, though. See you soon. Now, as you know, and you're probably sick of hearing it, 10x9 is always free. But if you'd like to help ensure our events and this podcast continue to thrive, you can help us out with a donation via Patreon. There's a link on our website. That's 10x9.com. As always, a big thank you to everyone who has given, whether electronically or at our live events over the years. It really helps, and we are so grateful. Thank you. And a big special shout out, actually, to Judy Daly, a listener in New York who got in touch. She's originally from Ireland, and she said she loves listening to the podcast. Thank you, Judy. Keep listening. Okay, on to our third and final story on this podcast. It was her first time at a 10x9, but she nailed it with this story. She had come all the way from the States, Chicago, I believe. Let me introduce you to Julie Kipp.
When my friend Jennifer Young checked into the hospital on St. Patrick's Day 2011, we were all caught off guard, as her pregnancy seemed to have been progressing normally. But in her 33rd week, she was diagnosed with preeclampsia, a life-threatening condition of pregnancy for which the only real cure is the immediate delivery of the baby. When I got to the emergency room that night, she told me the doctors wanted to hold off another week to give the baby a little bit more time. They were planning to transfer her the next day to a better-equipped hospital, but for the time being, they would monitor her in the emergency room while waiting for a bed upstairs. While we waited in the ER, Jen told me that both she and her sister Tanya had been born prematurely. She said her stepbrother's mother had died in childbirth, as had one of her second cousins. I was pretty shocked by these revelations, but I confess at this point I still felt no real fear for her, and to the contrary, I kept assuring her that everything would be okay. I had used natural childbirth techniques when my five children were born, and I was an advocate for empowering mothers and didn't want to encourage the idea that childbirth was a horrific experience. Besides, if she needed anything, we were sitting in an emergency room in the richest country in the world, surrounded by nurses, doctors, and machines designed to save lives. It never crossed my mind that Jen could be in danger. I had no idea that as a black woman in America, she was at much greater risk for life-threatening complications. That's what haunts me. And at first, Jen seemed fine, but about a half an hour after I arrived, she began to shift about in her bed and talk about how her stomach was bothering her. The pain spread to her back, and I remember feeling her belly because I thought she might be having contractions. I went out to the nurse's station at some point to report on Jen's symptoms, but the nurse seemed unconcerned and assured me there was nothing to do but encourage Jen to calm down. Instead, Jen just started getting louder and more upset. She started vomiting and then complaining that she was feeling very, very hot. Of course, I was now seriously alarmed, insisting that somebody get a doctor. Most worrisome, Jen was developing a headache, which rapidly became unbearable. The nurse kept monitoring Jen's blood pressure and telling her to just relax while we waited and waited and waited for a doctor. I remember one blood pressure reading 190 over 110 and saying, "Isn't that very high?" Jen grew so hot that she said she felt like her skin was burning, and finally she just tore off the hospital gown she was wearing, saying that it was hurting her skin. I could tell that the nurse was shocked and was actually judging Jen and finding her immodest and over the top and maybe even a little crazy. But it's clear now that Jen was growing frantic because she knew she was in grave danger, and she could tell no one was paying attention. I had arrived at the ER at about 7 p.m., and it was about 9:30 before an actual doctor came to see Jen. More than 2 hours after she started exhibiting signs that her preeclampsia was developing into full-blown eclampsia, a disease caused by the pregnancy itself, which kills mothers without mercy. After checking Jen's vitals, the on-call obstetrician gave her a shot of something for the nausea that she said also contained a strong sedative. She explained that Jen had a headache because she had been crying too much and that she was merely overly agitated, as though she was some troublesome patient who was making herself sick. And then she insisted that Jen needed sleep and that I had to leave. Obviously, I should never have left. I knew that something was wrong. In my gut, I knew it. But everyone standing around Jen's bed in the ER was acting and speaking as though they were on top of everything and treating me as though I was in the way. Jen's husband had arrived. My own kids were home alone. And so I did what the doctor told me and left for the night with a promise to be back first thing in the morning. I kissed Jen on the forehead and told her I'd see her the next day and said, I love you. But truthfully, I don't think she actually heard me. Her eyes were funny, and it seemed like she was concentrating on something far away. On my way out, the nurse who had been with me watching Jen deteriorate stopped me and said to me, what is she normally like? This seemed precisely the wrong question to ask. What do you mean, I said to her, she normally isn't experiencing an acute physical crisis. Normally she doesn't writhe around moaning or tear off her clothes. The nurse looked confused and, yes, finally looked scared. By this point, she must have recognized that Jen wasn't making a scene. She wasn't a loud, crazy black lady. The hospital staff had repeatedly told her and me that she just needed to calm down. And as I stood there watching, they basically did nothing during the brief window available during which they could have saved her. What is she normally like? This is one of the sound bites from that night that haunts me. We live in a town full of mostly tall, blonde, very white people, the descendants of Dutch immigrants. And I cannot help but think that the whole thing would have played out very differently if Jen had been pale-skinned, blue-eyed, and yellow-haired, like both her nurse and her doctor. I believe things would have played out differently if the hospital staff had been trained to recognize their own internal biases against outsiders. And I agonize over the recognition that Jen might still be alive if I had only known, as a self-professed feminist and ally, that statistically she was in much, much greater danger as a pregnant black woman in America, especially one with a family history of high-risk pregnancies, especially in a small hospital in a small town in the Midwest where well-meaning staff might not have a full understanding of how their assumptions about others could be lethal. I, too, should have seen more clearly, intervened more forcefully, advocated for her more persuasively. I should have raised bloody hell, stamped my feet, and shouted in the hallways that this was an emergency and something was going terribly, terribly wrong. I shouldn't have listened to the doctor. I should not have left her that night. Not that it likely would have made any difference at that point if I'd stayed. The disease had progressed too far. After sleeping for about an hour or so, knocked out by the sedative, Jen had a major seizure and then went into a coma after being delivered quickly by cesarean section of a son, Solomon. The next time I saw her, she was hooked up to a lot of machines, one of which was breathing for her. I asked one of the doctors, when she woke up, was there a possibility of brain damage? He looked at me a little incredulously and nodded his head. Yes. Oh, yes. We, her friends and family, said goodbye to her the next morning, after she had been pronounced dead and received last rites, and before they had harvested her organs, which saved four lives and enhanced the lives of dozens of others. The hospital staff brought Solomon to her room before they wheeled her away and placed him on the pillow beside her head. Jen's mother, Rose, took a picture, and that's another mental image that will haunt me forever. And yet, in the days and years that followed, I wanted so much to be haunted. I yearned for Jen's ghost to come visit me. She definitely believed in ghosts, and she shared with me a number of personal stories of visitations. In one, a ring of her grandmother's disappeared mysteriously without a trace and then reappeared just as strangely in a different place right after her grandmother had visited her in a dream and told her where to find the ring. I adored these stories of hers, and I believe in ghosts too, though I've still never been visited by one, not even by Jen's ghost, unfortunately. And yet, Jen's mother, Rose, tells me that when he was visiting her in the house where Jen grew up, Solomon, Jen's son, would sometimes become still and start staring into space, looking at an empty spot in the room. And then he would begin speaking to Jen as if she were there. He would have whole conversations with his mother, and they lasted for quite a while sometimes. Apparently, Solomon was not self-conscious about this. He never tried to explain what was happening, and Rose didn't ask or push. These extended chats went on for several years when Solomon was a small child. He'd just sit there chatting away with his mother, staring at a spot of emptiness in the room. After a couple of years, this suddenly stopped. Maybe Jen's spirit left because she knew he was okay and she was finally at peace. I like to carry that thought, even though I'm still kind of upset with her ghost. I would have thought she would know just how much I'd appreciate a visit myself, one chance to have a few words with her spectral self. Jen was only with me for a few short years, but she taught me so much about how to be alive. She loved me truly, and she changed me forever. I would say to her ghost, thank you. I would tell her, I'm sorry. And I would promise her, I'm going to keep trying and trying to let go of this pain, to let it float away like a leaf on a stream. I can just see her smiling ghost face now, nodding her head encouragingly just before she fades away.
Julie, what a wonderful story and a real tribute to Jen. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. Wonderful. And that's it for this podcast. You can keep up with all our upcoming events and themes by having a look at our website, 10by9.com. The dates for 2025 will be on the website soon. And while always free, some events outside Belfast might require tickets from the venues. 10by9 is on the socials, of course. Be sure to follow us on either Twitter, Facebook, and or Instagram. And I promise I will not flood your feed with nonsense, just information. Thanks to everyone who made 10by9 in Limavady happen. Everyone at the Roe Valley Arts, especially Denise and the team who made me so welcome. And Adam, who was our audio engineer. And what a wonderful, responsive audience. Thank you so much. A massive thank you, as always, to all our storytellers, but the biggest thanks this week goes to Mike Carlisle, Gloria O'Connor, and Julie Kipp. I'm Paul Dorn, and I'll be back with another podcast soon. But for now, bye-bye.